glad to see a good crowd out tonight in spite of the weather, and we have a real treat for you. Before we begin, let me remind the many people who are here today that it's helpful to join the Institute. We have desks outside, it's painless, it's income tax free, it's almost costless. To join the Institute costs a very tiny fraction of what it will cost you to come within a kilometer of the Three Tenors on New Year's Eve. So, also, you could then get notices of the, you'll get in the mail, early notices of what is awaiting you in the new term. We will begin after Christmas with a new Vancouver writer, Mike Harcourt, who will talk about the press. We will also have last year's Nobel Peace Prize winner, Joseph Rotblat, coming from London to talk about nuclear peace, and we will have many other treats for you in the new year. You don't have to join. You don't have to join to listen to the lectures. They're free lectures, but many people do and feel very happy about it. And so when you leave tonight, please join the Institute. Tonight's lecture is by Ira Nadell, who needs no introduction to a Vancouver audience. We hear him constantly on the CBC. In fact, I guess he causes more traffic accidents by the dramatic things that he says in late afternoon than anybody else. I also felt that the music in advance was to condition the audience, because we'd always hear his music just before and after his CBC commentaries. Ira Nadell is, of course, from our English department at UBC, and he's written many books and articles. He's a well-known public figure here, and he's recently just published a book, here it is, on Leonard Cohen. I think you'll hear something about it today. And you may even be interested enough then to purchase it, but that's not the purpose of the evening. The purpose of the evening is to,
of course it is.
Give you some information about Leonard Cohen in 1961 on a very early trip to Havana, and the lecture is called The Only Tourist in Havana. Ladies and gentlemen, Ira Nadell.
Can everyone hear me with this particular mic? I want you to know that we've taken tremendous precautions tonight. I'm wearing two microphones. There's one on the left for those who have those kind of inclinations, politically or otherwise, and then I have one on the right if you are more inclined to point in that direction. First of all, let me say what a great privilege it is to speak to the Institute tonight. I have, in one way or another, been involved with the Institute almost from the very beginning of my arrival here at UBC, and I want to say that it is one of the most vital elements that makes up both the intellectual community of this university, but also the larger public and their interest in the kind of ideas and activities that take place here at the university. And I'm very proud to have been asked and to speak to you tonight about some curious work that I have done over the past almost 2.5 or 3 years. Curious, as you'll see, because it will not strike you as being the very common everyday academic enterprise. And that is writing the biography of the Canadian singer, poet, songwriter, bon vivant, and as you'll hear in a moment, he's been called an awful lot of other things, Leonard Cohen. I want to say, first of all, how I'm going to present this, because much of this will be in a suitable Leonard Cohen environment, that is to say, in the dark. I will, not what I say, of course, but the way it will be presented, because I'll be showing a series of slides to accompany my remarks, which are going to basically be divided into three parts. The first is an introduction on how I met Leonard Cohen. The second deals with some thoughts I have on the issues of biography, trying to write biography, what are the problems of a biography, what are the particular problems in writing about a living subject. And then finally, we will get to Cuba. And I want to narrate for you a very interesting, a very dramatic episode in Leonard Cohen's life, which I certainly didn't know about before I undertook this project. And it has to do with Leonard being in Havana during the Bay of Pigs invasion and some remarkable things that occurred during that particular time. But there's a very simple way of trying to understand what it is I want to convey tonight. And that simple way is to try and answer a question that Leonard Cohen's mother always asked his sister. Leonard has a sister who's 4 years older named Esther Cohen. And I was with Esther Cohen just about 2 weeks ago. She's still talking to me now that the book is done and out. One of the reasons she's talking to me, to digress for a second, is that there are three photographs of Esther in the book, and she's never looked so great. The first picture, Esther is 8 years old. The second picture, Esther is 21 years old. And the third picture, she's maybe 26. She's considerably older today. We'll just leave it at that. This was the question that Masha Cohen always asked Esther every time she saw her. She said, "Esther, what's going to happen to Leonard?" How long can Leonard go around the world with a guitar? The answer actually is 47 years. Leonard Cohen was 15 when he got his first guitar, and he's now 62 years old. Another item that I'd like to deal with is this absolutely scandalous remark in the current issue of Chatelaine magazine. You can all run out to the village and pick up the December issue, where this book is reviewed. And it says the following: Leonard Cohen gets the serious treatment, but he ultimately remains elusive. Well, is he going to still remain elusive when we collectively encounter him? Now, I mentioned something about this lecture being in the dark, so let's see if we can start that. And here we go. Okay. I'm going to be showing a series of slides which sometimes relate to this talk and sometimes don't at all. So you'll be able to relax and enjoy yourself. Now, Leonard Cohen's been called the Prince of Bummers, the Poet Laureate of Pessimism, the Buster Keaton of Despair, the Master of Mortification and the Century of Servitude, as well as the leading exponent of folk noir, the first white rap singer, the makeout musician of all time, and, if you'll excuse the language, the Poet Laureate of pubic pleasure. But if you are from another generation, you may feel more comfortable with this epithet, the Barry Manilow, for people with BA degrees. Now, Leonard himself has called himself the patron saint of envy and the grocer of despair. It's a line from one of his songs. And he's tolerated such reviews of his music, which have these headlines: music for musical sadists, or the commander-in-chief of grief. But I want you to know that Leonard Cohen has struck back. Yes, he has. He's castigated his critics for his knowing only three chords, when in fact Leonard Cohen knows four. Privately, Leonard has identified himself as a romantic pilgrim, faithful to love and fully confessed to beauty. Or in less generous moments, he's called himself in a letter to his brother-in-law, quote, a hopelessly bourgeois anarchist bohemian. Leonard, in a red chair, about a year ago, at a used furniture shop in Los Angeles. In 1984, a journalist opened a review of Book of Mercy by declaring, the details of Leonard Cohen's life are so familiar they could be recited as stations of the cross along the way to his becoming Canada's most notorious poet, folk singer, guru, martyr. But you know, things have changed since 1984. Some, I have to say, have lost the faith. Others have just lost his records. Cohen himself has covered up or even hidden his past as well as his present, creating a mythology of his origins and actions. Yet every few years, to continue the religious metaphor, Cohen is resurrected and indeed a new record or possibly a book appears. And I think we could say that although Leonard Cohen has occasionally been out of fashion, note my chair, Leonard Cohen has also never left the scene. But how did I come to know Leonard Cohen and write his biography? And what did I discover in the process? And why did he reject the request to call the book An Authorized Life, offering instead that amazingly Cone-esque phrase, tolerated, which he quickly revised to benignly tolerated. Well, perhaps I can offer some answers this evening while explaining his directive to me, don't let the facts get in the way of the truth. My first meeting with Leonard Cohen. It occurred on the 12th of May, 1993, just after a marathon show he put on at the Royal Albert Hall in London that saw a standing room only crowd leap out of their seats for every encore. Now, I, of course, was no different, but I found that I couldn't get backstage, not at least until the two British security guards realized that, frankly, they had worked enough overtime and suddenly took off. Well, I rushed downstairs to a bewildering group of people, all of them too tall to be Leonard Cohen. Well, suddenly his drummer appeared, and I prevailed on him to introduce me, and he returned in a moment to guide me into the dressing room where the well-dressed singer was greeting a select few, and I shall never forget the first words that Leonard Cohen ever said to me in that croaky voice, once generously described as resembling an abused cello. And those words were, have something to eat. Well, I was surprised. There was no welcome. There was no angst. There was just appetite. And so, of course, I followed his cue, and I went directly to the cheese and wine provided by Sony, he assured me. A few non-sequiturs later, I mustered the courage to ask him to sign my program, which he did with the enigmatic phrase, fraternal greetings. Well, I want you to know I treasured this personal remark for many years. Well, at least three, since I only met him in 93, until I found that someone in this audience, I'll name him Stephen Scobie, and others received the exact same inscription. Well, I left, only to realize out the door and down the street that I had forgotten to ask him any of the questions I had long ago prepared. In February of 1994, I had another chance. Through accident, good luck, and a remarkably short early morning phone call, Cohen invited me to visit him in Los Angeles. I came prepared with the essential tools of any biographer. Montreal smoked meat, BC smoked salmon, and a bottle of Chateau Latour 84. You see, at $300 a bottle, his favorite Chateau Latour 82 was simply beyond my research budget. I want you to know that Random House, as well as research offices here, do have its limits. Well, we met in the sunny kitchen of his modest home, and he responded again with, let's eat. This is a theme, as you gathered, throughout my research, despite my thin frame. There was a good deal of eating in the course of researching this book. One of the things that happened during that visit, and I think this will illustrate it. I'm sorry it's such a bad slide, but it's a very important moment. When I went down, I was teaching a course in continuing ed on Leonard Cohen, and I said to the class that we weren't going to meet the following week because, believe it or not, I was going to see Leonard Cohen. And one of the students said that he was a photographer, and could he possibly take a picture of the class, and would I dare to show the photograph and present it to Leonard Cohen. And I said, well, okay. So a black and white 8x10 was taken of all the students, mostly adults in the class, and they all stood there very proudly holding up in front of them their copies of Leonard's latest book, which is Stranger Music, 1993, the anthology. And the photo was taken and a few days later given to me. So during this first meeting with Leonard, I had the photo in my briefcase, and at a certain point, I guess 3/4 of the Chateau Latour 84 was gone. I said, Leonard, I do have one more thing for you, but, well, I'm slightly embarrassed. And he said, what is it? And I said, well, it's this photograph. And I took it out, and I showed him. And he said, come here. We went into his bedroom, and he handed me a Polaroid camera. And he said, take my picture. And this is the picture that was taken with Leonard holding the class picture. Well, that was pretty interesting. And then he took the small Polaroid, of which this is a very poor reproduction, I'm sorry to say, and he wrote in magic marker on it, hi, friends, and then you can't see it off to your right, love, Leonard. And that was pretty nice, too. But then he did something which I found a very telling gesture. We went to his office and we made 35 color Xeroxes of that picture, so that when I came back to Vancouver at the next meeting of the class, every student received a photograph from Leonard Cohen. That to me was a very important illustration of the kind of person that I would discover. And every encounter that I've had with Leonard, as recently as last week, or not, excuse me, not last week, 2 days ago, so time's changing, illustrated that kind of generosity. So, subsequent visits to Leonard's office, the Zen Center, and his home have given me a glimpse into the life, and I have to say, the recipes of the man. I can tell you where Leonard Cohen buys his sunglasses, washes his car, and buys his sake. And once in an upscale supermarket in Claremont, California, food and, yes, sex came together. Leonard, you see, was buying some fish. It was sea bass, I recall. And we were buying fish to go up, or food to go up to the Mount Baldy Zen Center. And he was discussing recipes with the clerk, a young woman. And when you're with Leonard, the women that tend to appear always seem young. This woman appeared in a tracksuit. This is not a picture of the woman, okay? This is Leonard in his Richard Gere phase, okay? But it's appropriate for the story I'm going to tell, to which I, of course, was witness. So this young woman appeared in a tracksuit, evidently just back from a workout. She suddenly paused as she walked by, mesmerized by this figure in a gray suit, black t-shirt, dark sunglasses, and yes, cowboy boots, discussing the refinement of sauces. At one point, entirely unable to contain herself any longer, she thrust herself forward and asked, unaware of his identity, "Excuse me, but how do you know so much about fish?" Well, Leonard, who had noticed her presence some minutes before, slowly turned, smiled, and he said one word, but he said it very carefully: experience. Well, only her clutching the counter prevented her from collapsing to the floor. I'm not making it up. She recovered enough composure to ask him to repeat the recipe, which he did as she wrote it down. But midway in his monologue, Leonard quizzically looked into her by now glazed eyes and said, "I'll bet your man doesn't even eat fish." Blushing, the woman admitted that this was true. Leonard, ever the gentleman, continued and then offered her a steak recipe, which he eagerly copied. And then with a flourish, we exited while the woman continued to stare at him transfixed. Leonard and women. It's a topic that preoccupied me throughout the book as story after story emerged. And one of my favorites occurred at a Montreal party in the early 1970s. Leonard spied a woman with remarkably rich, dark hair running down the middle of her back. He walked up to her. He grabbed some of that hair in his hand. He dipped it in his wine glass. He pulled it out and he sucked it dry. He then turned and left without saying a word. David Gilmour on CBC, I think News World, commented on this incident and said, "You know, that's the kind of action that would either get you a knife in the heart or an anecdote in a biography." So it's in a biography. Now, the Quebec actress André Pelletier in 1982 may have indeed summarized the situation of Leonard Cohen and women best. Interviewed for Montreal's City Woman magazine, she was asked if she and Leonard were ever lovers. "Well, yes, we were lovers," she replied. "But is there anyone who's lived in Montreal and hasn't slept with Leonard Cohen?" But to Cuba, with this sentence from a 1963 letter as an introduction. And this is a sign for me to remove one of these seven microphones, I think. So let me just put it here. Okay. This is a sentence from a letter that Leonard Cohen wrote after Cuba. But I like it very much. "It's hard to be a poet maudit when you have a good tan." Says a lot. The only tourist in Havana turns his thoughts homeward. Leonard Cohen's often anthologized poem appears in his 1964 collection, Flowers for Hitler. The poem is a series of comic challenges to his fellow Canadians. Let us sell snow to underdeveloped nations. Let us give Canada Council fellowships to the most original suggestions. Let us teach sex in the home to parents. Well, this poem surprisingly contains only one reference to Cuba, other than its title, and that is the closing geographical signature, which reads Havana / April 1961. But what I want to do now is explore that place and time in the context of Leonard Cohen's life through the discourse of biography. And not surprisingly, what follows draws from the research that I've done in writing Leonard's life, a work, by the way, that required not only a saddleless horseback ride to the top of a Greek mountain in the Aegean, a daring leap over a cattle fence in rural Tennessee, attendance at dawn at a Buddhist ceremony in the California mountains, but yes, as you would expect, the need to learn the words to at least 10 Leonard Cohen songs. Leonard Cohen has sung Everybody Knows, but a biographer, I think, always knows too much. This is Leonard, by the way, posing for Montreal Life magazine, and you can see why the woman in the supermarket, even though this occurred last year, in a sense was attracted to him. This is a very unusual representation of Leonard Cohen. He was still not sure of which direction he was headed. Remember, this is the man who was the president of his fraternity at McGill, president of the McGill Debating Society, and who attended law school at McGill University for one term. This is the other Leonard Cohen. Okay, Leonard has sung Everybody Knows, but a biographer, I think, always knows too much. As a professional burglar, that's an unpleasant but perhaps apt phrase from Janet Malcolm, who used it in her study of Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes, which is entitled The Silent Woman. Well, the biographer gathers up details, stories, names, scraps and incidents from any and every source. At a transcendental meditation session, I discovered someone who had nightclubbed with Cohen in Montreal and clarified for me the title of his opera, Night Music. Here at UBC, I located someone whose father sold Leonard Cohen a chicken. Couldn't remember anything else, but he remembered selling him the chicken. It was wonderful. In Los Angeles, I located one of his record producers who played for me unreleased tapes of Leonard Cohen reciting his 1984 volume, which consists of 50 psalms. He was 50 years old when he published the book, Book of Mercy. There are unreleased tapes of Leonard reciting that Book of Mercy with a string quartet. And also in California, I found buried in the back of a locked garage the first draft manuscript of what became Leonard Cohen's first published novel. Letters turned up in startling locations and sources appeared at unexpected moments. And if we have time, remind me to tell you the story of Leonard Cohen's, I think, well-known poem written on the wall of a Montreal bistro, which reads, Marita, please find me. I'm almost 30. Well, once the hoarding or fact-gathering or collecting is done, the biographer faces his or her greatest challenge, fashioning, distilling, condensing, and even concealing the material into a narrative that will both tell the story accurately and yet reflect the drives, the desires, and the character of the subject, the fictions, if you will, that he or she lives by. Biography, I would argue, is in fact an exhaustive fiction. Exhaustive in the sense of the researching, collecting, interviewing, and compiling details by the biographer of his subject's life, but fiction in the sense of recreating out of this archive a narrative and an image which contains or embodies the ideals, self-images, and ideology of the subject. And this picture, for me, represents that collection of material. If you think of the graffiti in this on the walls of this Italian schoolroom where Leonard Cohen is entertaining students in about 1974 in Italy, everything and the full photograph shows much, much more in terms of the kind of chaos that took place in that classroom, suggests to me something of the amount of collected material that the biographer must ultimately deal with. I'm reminded of a remark that Tom Stoppard made in 1992 when he claimed that a play is not a text. A play is something much greater than a text that requires the performance of the actors and the direction of a good director, if you will. Well, similarly, I think a biography is not a life. A biography is a narrative. It's a construction with a point of view, a narrator, a set of themes, and a hero. Now, according to the biographer Richard Holmes, the source of this contradictory process, that of history blended with fiction, is actually an unholy alliance. To quote Richard Holmes, fiction marries fact without the benefit of a clergy. Unquote. Invention and truth, they form an unavoidable match. And using less social or more theoretical vocabulary, for the biographer, the textual details of a life constitute its theory, with biographical narrative constructing the individual space of its subject. Creating the body of the subject through its history, through research and records, is stage one. In stage two, the biographer reverses the process and learns how to embody the thought or character of the subject in the text he creates. The architecture of biography is intertextual. Biography constructs itself from texts or documents of one sort or another into a new text that subsumes its predecessors. What results is a documented fiction, which readers often misappropriate as fact. Virginia Woolf recognized this development when she wrote that, quote, the life which is increasingly real to us is the fictional life, unquote, a statement that she made in the 1920s. We might think of a published biography as a fingerprint, perhaps a thumbprint, of the biographer's hand, which actually has before it much more than it can hold. Yet the work unquestionably bears this imprint of the biographer. It consists of those elements chosen by the biographer that aid in understanding the motives and the sources, the self-revelatory moments of the subject, who the subject is, not what the subject does, strikes me as the most valuable component of any biography. When Leonard Cohen tells an interviewer, Leonard has been listening to me, and you can see the boredom on his face at this point. This is a photo taken by Dominique Isserman, the third sort of significant woman in his life, a French photographer, a very successful fashion photographer who lives in Paris, but the photograph was taken in Santa Monica. When Leonard Cohen tells an interviewer, he is a formal, and I'm quoting Leonard, a formal, uptight, agonized most of the time, and adds that he has to do a lot of undressing before I can get to the truth. I'm not a spontaneous, visceral kind of chap. The biographer must provide the reader with an understanding of what has fashioned the subject into that position. And since we're a small and intimate group here, I suppose that I can share with you what I have found the most undressed moment of Leonard Cohen. No, oh, we missed that one. That's out. Oh, it's coming. Leonard singing in the 1960s. Let's see if this is the right one. No. Well, that one must be gone. We'll come to this one again.
You skipped over one.
Did I? No, let's go back one. There it is. You see, part of this talk is X-rated, and that's why I went through that so quickly. So here is the most undressed image I have of Leonard Cohen. And he's with his dog, Kellef, all right? Appropriately named, of course. It's not history, but interpretation that the biographer writes in his representation of the self, establishing biographical truth by what is narrated, not by what actually happened. Interestingly, when not enough material exists, the biographer herself or himself often enters the fiction temporarily and competes with the subject. And a very fine illustration of this is Rosemary Sullivan's engaging biography, Shadowmaker, Life of Gwendolyn McEwen, as well as an earlier book called Quest for Corvo by A.J.A. Simmons. Well, I could go on at length about various incidents from Cohn's high school days or his first day on the island of Hedra, or why he keeps a map of Canada tacked to the wall of his Los Angeles music room. But what would they mean without the shaping fiction of his life, marked most significantly by the early loss of his father, by the rejection of middle-class Westmount, and a determination to embrace desire in his art? Much of this he manifests in a relentless search for beauty, which paradoxically, once he attains it, he rejects it. As he confesses in a poem called My Life in Art, he writes the following: 6:50 a.m., ruined in Los Angeles. I want to die in her arms and leave her. Now, he writes this statement at the Chateau Marmont on Sunset Boulevard in 1974. Entrapped by beauty, his art is imperiled. He has no choice but to depart. He wants love, but he cannot be in love. The pattern repeats itself throughout his work, as he recognizes in the final poem of his 1993 collection entitled Stranger Music. That poem is called Days of Kindness, and it's probably the most sentimental poem, I think, that Leonard Cohn has certainly written in the last 15 years. The guitar. Desire and art plagued Cohn in the early spring of 1961 when he left Canada to explore the socialist revolution of Cuba, only to find himself entangled in the Bay of Pigs invasion, leading to his arrest and then escape from the country. The result of this adventure was not only several poems, a beard, and a new appreciation of a seersucker suit, which you'll hear about in a moment, but a completely altered set of values. Quote, poetry, as he would later admit, is no substitute for survival. Cuba had for years been of some interest to the Cohn household. His parents had actually gone there on their honeymoon, and his sister Esther and her husband visited in 1957 on their own honeymoon. Leonard Cohn was eager to see the new socialist revolution firsthand after Castro had come to power in January 1959, and frankly, he was happy to escape the chill and the social and, I dare say, sexual constraints of Montreal in the winter of 1960. At that point in time, he took a bus to Miami. It was late March, and Claire Pratt, his editor at McClellan and Stewart and the daughter of E.J. Pratt, lamented that, quote, the day you left for Cuba, the page proofs of the Spice Box of Earth came in. And now I'm wondering, what are we going to do? A short Pan Am flight on the 30th of March put Cohn in Havana, which was hot and falling apart. 31 years earlier, almost to the day, Garcia Lorca, the poet Cohn had idolized since he had first read him at the age of 15, made a similar trip to Havana, and part of Cohn's attraction to the island may have been that it so excited his literary mentor. Lorca's successful three-month stay, beginning in April 1930, included lectures and poetry readings, often while performing on the piano, as well as, and I think this definitely appealed to Leonard at that time, a crocodile hunt. The island is a paradise, Lorca exclaimed to his parents. Cuba, if you can't find me, look for me in Andalusia or in Cuba. Well, the danger of a tropical island that was led by someone the world considered a madman and that was nearly at the point of war with Yankee imperialists was simply too thrilling for Leonard Cohn to resist. He writes, I am wild for all kinds of violence. By the spring of 1961, he was ready to test his declaration, although he later confessed that he went not so much to support Castro as to pursue a fiction. Quote, I had this mythology of this famous civil war in my mind. I thought maybe this was my Spanish Civil War, but it was a shabby kind of support. It was really mostly curiosity and a sense of adventure. When Cohn arrived, he found a splendid city in decay. The skyscrapers of Vidado, the business center west of the old city, were falling into disrepair with cracking facades and broken windows. The once striking pastels of the elegant homes in Cubanacan and El Trero had faded, and the peasant families who now lived in these homes did not know or care about how to maintain them. Walls were crumbling, paint was peeling, and weeds were sprouting everywhere. Manicured lawns had turned brown, and goats grazed alongside the swimming pools. Elegant cars had been replaced by barely running taxis. The Havana Country Club was the new National School of Art, and the Prado, an imposing, high-ceilinged, European-style building, once an elite Spanish heritage club, was filled with gym mats for its new use as a gymnastics center and fencing club. But the labyrinths of the old city, with its famous cathedral square, its old mansions and fortresses, reflected Havana's colonial Spanish past. Its narrow cobbled streets and tiled roofs still evoked a glorious Spanish architecture. The city, which was once praised as the Paris of the Caribbean, boasted a modest nightlife, but the city had also been called the whorehouse of America. And boatloads of prostitutes once greeted tourists as they traveled up the narrow waterway that separated Morro Castle, with its famed lighthouse at the harbor entrance, from the city. Under Batista, the government actually disguised these profitable prostitution rings as dance academies. Although when Leonard Cohen arrived, a program to reform the nearly 11,000 prostitutes of Havana was underway. It was pretty difficult, however, to rid each neighborhood of its local brothel. Gambling, once a source of immense revenue, had now become a backstreet affair, but the exotic appeal of the sensual Cuban world could not be erased, not even by socialism. Despite the new reforms, a certain lasciviousness still hovered about the city, and Cohn rapidly fell into what he ironically remembers as his old bourgeois ways, staying up late to explore the night scene. This habit began in his teenage years and continued throughout his life, and he would often be up writing, drinking, or talking at 3 a.m., his favorite morning hour. He also adopted the fashionable rebel garb. Leonard Cohen is in the middle of this photograph. It's a very important photograph, and I'll explain why in the next moment or two. He adopted the fashionable rebel garb, khaki shorts, although he's wearing pants here, and the fresh stubble of a new beard. But very few citizens were on the streets, and certainly not the East Bloc and Soviet technicians and aides, nor the Czech translators, members of Polish trade delegations, or Russian workers who made up the then transient population. Only the prostitutes appeared, those that congregated along the Malecón, the broad boulevard that edged the ocean, or those he met in the old city that kept company with him. Of black and Spanish heritage, these chocolate-skinned women with marvelous figures expressed an eroticism that Cohn found irresistible. Joining the hookers, the pimps, the gamblers, the small-time criminals, and the black marketeers who prowled Havana all night, Cohn roamed the city from urban slums to the swank waterfront suburbs, from back alleys to little bars in old Havana, and indeed even to the once-renowned Tropicana, which had claimed to be the largest dance hall in the world. In this crowd of revelers, as in the crowd of fellow travelers in late-night Montreal, Leonard Cohn felt elated because he was the center of attention, literally becoming, as his poem says, the only tourist in Havana. Disconnected from his Canadian past, he found new liberty in a tropical present. But late one night, at his small downtown Havana hotel, the past caught up with him. An official from the Canadian government knocked loudly on his door, politely but earnestly telling Cohn that, quote, his presence was requested immediately at the Canadian embassy. Looking back on the incident, Cohn remembered that he felt apprehensive but excited. I was Upton Sinclair. I was on an important mission. Well, feeling feisty and emancipated, Cohn accompanied the dark-suited figure to the embassy to be ushered immediately into the office of the vice consul, who took an instant dislike to him, his beard, and of course his khaki outfit. The official disdainfully conveyed the dramatic, but we must admit, anticlimactic news to the pseudo-Montreal revolutionary. Your mother's very worried about you. It turned out that because three bombers flown from Nicaragua by Florida-based Cuban revolutionaries had staged a minor attack on the Havana airport, exaggerated in the world press as an all-out war on the country, Cohn's mother had worriedly contacted Laz Phillips, a Canadian senator who was her cousin. He had to find her son quickly and confirm his safety. The Canadians did so, to the chagrin of Cohn and, yes, the Canadian vice consul. The threat of invasion, however, put everyone on alert and actually led to Cohn's arrest. Not very surprising, since Castro had detained nearly 50,000 suspected dissidents in the preceding months. One evening, soon after arriving at the Hotel Miramar at Playa de Varadero, you'll hear where it is, Cohn went out walking on the world-famous beach of pure white sand, 140 kilometers east of Havana. Wandering about late at night, wearing his khakis and carrying a hunting knife, he was suddenly surrounded by 12 soldiers with Czech submachine guns. They were convinced they had caught the first of the American landing team. Speaking a language he could not understand, they promptly marched Cohn to the local police station while he repeated the only Spanish he knew, which was the slogan of Castro's, Amistad del Pueblo, friendship of the people. This made little difference to his captors. They were even more convinced he was an American since he said it so badly. After an hour and a half interrogation, however, he convinced them that he was not a spy, but a fan of the regime who wanted to be there. Well, shortly after he persuaded them of his intentions, Cohn and his captors embraced, brought out the rum, and started a party. Now, the soldiers were, in fact, milicianos, and to confirm their goodwill, they placed a necklace of shells and a string hung with two bullets around Cohn's neck. He spent the next day with them, and when they offered him a ride to Havana, he gladly accepted. As they were walking down a street in Havana later that afternoon, a photographer snapped their picture, and this is it. Cohn wearing his khakis and his necklace. After the picture was developed, he took it, stuffed it in his knapsack. Following his adventure on the beach, Cohn returned to the Havana night scene, meeting more artists and writers and arguing with them about how they could sustain their artistic freedom in the face of political oppression. He also ran into a number of American communists, and he quickly disagreed with their views and had a violent argument with one who spat at him and declared that he would denounce the Canadian poet, who was clearly nothing more than a mere bourgeois. Cohn decided to accept the tag and play the part. He shaved his beard, he removed his khakis, and he put on his best Canadian seersucker suit. Well, he kept meeting members of this group at numerous cafes where they congratulated each other on the confirmation of their suspicions. In their eyes, Cohn was clearly a bourgeois individualist. Meanwhile, in Montreal, Irving Layton, as well as Cohn's mother, was now pretty worried. Following the attack on the Havana airport on the 15th of April, he hastily wrote to tell Cohn to leave as soon as possible. This is Layton to Cohn. There is no time for a footloose, reckless poet to find himself on the island. And Layton expressed the same view to his friend Desmond Pacey. Layton was convinced that within days an invasion would occur and that Cohn would be swept up and possibly harmed in the ensuing confusion. Layton was right. The danger that existed throughout Cuba for foreigners was intensified by the January suspension of diplomatic relations between the United States and Cuba and the constant rhetoric of anti-imperialism. The Bay of Pigs invasion on the 17th of April, 1961, confirmed the Cubans' fear, although Castro's unexpected success in defeating 1,300 U.S.-trained Cuban invaders solidified his power and stature. Despite such upheavals, Cohn found the official attitude of the government, in his words, impeccable, even towards someone as, quote, ambiguous and ambivalent as myself, unquote. But the novelty of the visit was wearing off as daily life became more perilous for foreigners. Tourists were arrested daily without explanation. The day after the invasion, Cohn wrote to Jack McClellan, ostensibly to thank him for his first literary contract, ironically adding as a postscript to the letter, just think how well the book will sell if I'm hit in an air raid. What great publicity. Don't tell me you haven't been considering it. He then gives this report of the events the night of the invasion. Quote, there was a prolonged round of anti-aircraft fire tonight. An unidentified, but we know Yankee plane. I think the guns were in the room next door. I looked out the window. Half a platoon running down the Prado, then crouching behind an iron lion. hopelessly Hollywood. Well, soon after, Cohn tried to get out, only to discover that most of Havana's middle class was also trying to get out. Daily visits to the shell-struck Jose Marti Airport, 25 kilometers southwest of the city, to get a seat became a fruitless ritual, although he soon befriended others in the waiting line, including the editor of the monthly review, A Socialist Magazine, who was also pretty eager to leave. No seats were to be had on the one or two daily flights to Miami. Nevertheless, Cohn eventually managed to get a reservation. But standing in line on April 26th, the day he was to depart, he was astonished to hear the officials call the name of the person in front of him and the name of the person behind him, but not his own. Looking at the officials' list, he saw that a line had been drawn through his name. Ordered to go to the security desk, he was then courteously informed by a Cuban official that he could not leave the country. The reason? A picture of him, dressed as a miliciano and standing with two other soldiers, had been found in his knapsack. And there it is. They thought he was an escaping Cuban. The fact that he had also with him a copy of Castro's Declaration of Havana, which, by the way, he still has, which condemns American exploitation of Cuba, did not help his claim that he was a foreigner, while his Canadian passport was thought instantly to have been a forgery. Cohn was taken to a security area outside the waiting room, where he was guarded by a 14-year-old with a rifle. Arguing with the youth about his detention and his rights as a Canadian citizen had no effect. Suddenly, a commotion on the runway distracted the truculent guard. Several Cubans were being evicted from a plane, and when they resisted, a tumultuous argument broke out. The guard instantly ran to the scene. For a moment, Cohn was unwatched. He quickly repacked his bag and calmly but nervously walked to the plane amid all the confusion, repeating to himself, "It's going to be okay. They don't really care about me." Purposefully, he climbed on board, telling himself not to look back. He took a seat and didn't move. No one asked for tickets. After a few anxious moments, the door shut, the engine started, the plane began to taxi down the runway. It was soon airborne, and he was on his way to Miami. In a 5-page letter written 18 months later, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Cohn explained to his brother-in-law, Victor Cohn, why he went to Cuba. A politicized Cohn emphatically declared that he opposed all forms of censorship, collectivism, and control, and that he rejected all hospitality offered by the Cuban government to visiting writers during his stay. Furthermore, he wanted his brother-in-law to understand that he went to Cuba, quote, to see a socialist revolution, not to wave a flag or prove a point. Cuba, however, was also a time for writing as well as revolution, and in addition to poems, Cohn began a novel, of which 5 pages survive. At one time, it was called The Famous Havana Diary, although in the text, the narrator says it might also be called Havana Was No Exception. And it opens like a Raymond Chandler mystery. The city was Havana. That's about all in the way of detail that you're going to get from me, unquote. Is there any reason why it's only 5 pages? The story quickly moves into a very self-conscious but at times comic account of his Cuban adventures. But beneath the comedy, however, is a distinctly autobiographical voice, and here's a paragraph. Reader, may I ask you to reserve your opinion of me? All my life I have suffered from unreserved opinions. They have forced me to take intolerable positions. I always wanted to be the lover of some woman who I did not surround with an opinion. A woman who did not live between the stones of my perfectly ordinary world. And that's a very Cohn-esque phrase, isn't it? The stones of my perfectly ordinary world. The unfinished text provides some flashes of the authentic Cohn with a touch of surrealism as he describes a Havana newspaper stand and a taste of the moralist as he rhetorically asks, who can deny the pleasure of seeing lies, detecting them, catching them? Well, by the 3rd of May, Leonard Cohen was back in Montreal after stopping in New York to see a friend of his named Yaffa Lerner. Yaffa remembers him as profoundly changed by his Cuban experience, but also, for the first time, more aware of his role as a Canadian poet grounded in the international scene. In Montreal, he told Leighton that Castro was a tragic figure. Nonetheless, he believes him to be, as I do, Leighton explained to his friend Desmond Pacey, a genuine revolutionary. On the 4th of May, Cohen dropped his revolutionary guise to appear on the stage of the O'Keeffe Center in Toronto as part of the Canadian Conference of the Arts, where he read his poetry and that of Anne Hébert. Luminaries surrounded him. On the stage was Northrop Frye, Mordecai Richler, Jay McPherson, Hugh McLennan, and George Lamming. Although it was Irving Layton who took the spotlight with a reading of his new poem about Jacqueline Kennedy entitled, Why I Don't Make Love to the First Lady. Layton reported that Cohen read beautifully and looked quite Dorian Grayish. Now in mid-May of 1961, Cohen was dealing with the publication and sudden fame of The Spice Box of Earth. Although an incident at the McGill bookstore nearly ended his incipient poetic career, unpacking copies of the volume, Marquita de Crevier and George Ramsey, who was head of the bookstore, discovered that the books were actually blind, that is, mistakenly bound with blank pages. Now, when Cohen heard of the mix-up, he said that if he had been there to witness the event, he would have been unable to continue writing poetry. I love that. Reaction to the finished book was enthusiastic and admiring, and a launch party at his mother's home to mark its publication on the 27th of May, 1961, with Leighton and McClellan in attendance, was a great success. The volume, of course, would become his first Canadian hit. On the rear dust jacket, the following account of this young, little-known poet appears, and I'd like to read it because it reveals a lot about the way Leonard Cohen thought of himself in 1961. He wrote this. And we need an appropriate photograph to go along with it. You're probably familiar with this image. It was used for the NFB film of 1964-5. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Leonard Cohen. He's standing, as I say in a caption in the book, on the plank. He's actually in the harbor at Hydra, where the supposed town is. It's where we're sitting, and the harbor is behind him, and that's a small naval academy directly behind him there. Leonard Cohen, 27, McGill graduate, gives his address as Montreal, but as this book was going to press, he was en route to Cuba. He spent last year on the shores of the Aegean Sea, writing as a result of that experience, quote, I shouldn't be in Canada at all. Winter is all wrong for me. I belong beside the Mediterranean. My ancestors made a terrible mistake. But I have to keep coming back to Montreal to renew my neurotic affiliations. Greece has the true philosophic climate. You cannot be dishonest in that light. But it's only in Montreal that you can get beaten up for wearing a beard. I love Montreal. I hate the speculators who are tearing down my favorite streets and erecting those prisons built in the habit of boredom and gold. While he prefers swimming in the Aegean, Leonard Cohen admits a fondness for camping in northern Quebec. Sure. He's currently engaged in writing a novel, unquote. Well, this campy biographical note provides a comic antidote to the youthful but serious portrait of the poet presented in a very arty snapshot on the elegantly produced cover of the book. Stressing the exotic and the unorthodox, the description makes it clear that Cohen is someone special and in many ways distinctly un-Canadian. Well, adulation greeted the publication of The Spice Box of Earth. The critic Robert Weaver found it powerful and referred to Cohen as, quote, probably the best young poet in English Canada right now, unquote. Professor Louis Dudek, poet Eli Mandel, and writer Stephen Vincenzi all found qualities to praise. Others, like the critic Arnold Edinburgh, suggested that Cohen had taken over from Leighton as Canada's major poet. And the critic Milton Wilson, in Letters in Canada 1961, noted the union of love and horror in the poems, although he questioned the high ferment of style. Nonetheless, he declared The Spice Box of Earth an important book. The title of the review that appeared in Canadian Literature, the journal founded here at UBC, summarized the general response, quote, "The lean and the luscious," unquote. And in Desmond Pacey, in the second edition of his quite respected Creative Writing in Canada, the volume published in 1961, wrote that Leonard Cohen was, quote, "easily the most promising among a group of younger poets in a country that included Al Purdy and Phyllis Webb." However, the big however, despite the praise and popularity of The Spice Box of Earth, it did sell out in 3 months, the book failed to win the Governor General's Award for Poetry. The victor, as I'm sure you're all familiar with, we might have a quiz when I'm done. The victor that year was a book by Robert Finch, and the title of it was Acis in Oxford. This was a mistake to many, but to some an absolute travesty, particularly Irving Layton, who wrote, "There isn't a goddamn single poem in that Finch book that won it. It's dull, academic stuff, with not one alive line that can seriously be called poetry. Exercises, bloody, or rather bloodless exercises, nothing else. What an asshole of a country this is, when that sort of crap can win prizes." It's a rather understated statement, as you see. But Cohen's genuine lyricism can't and doesn't. He also relates that Cohen was quite upset at not winning, adding that he had a letter and a poem from Cohen, as he explains to Pacey. The poem's no good. The letter, rather depressed and depressing. Psychologically, I think he's having a rough time of it. It's damn hard to be a young poet, unquote. But if the Governor General's jury wouldn't acknowledge the power of The Spice Box of Earth, the public certainly did. The handsomely designed text continued to sell and won its designer, Frank Neufeldt, a major publishing award. Cohen, however, and quite characteristic of him, was not around for much of the attention. In late May, that same year, 1961, Cohen received his Canada Council Arts Scholarship renewal, although it was only for $1,000. With chutzpah, Cohen told the supervisor of scholarships that the council's investment, quote, "will yield profits far out of proportion to the original risk." I love that. "Within the year, I promise you a book which will have some importance in our national literature." He then boldly asked for a travel grant, since he had required assistance for the fare back to Hedra, noting that, quote, "distance is essential if I am to get any perspective in this messy semi-autobiography." He concludes that, "in any case, it's to the Aegean I'm heading, although the bureaucrat should not worry about his becoming an expatriate. Quote, I could never stay away from Montreal for very long," unquote. By August 1961, Leonard Cohen was back in Greece. This is a picture of Leonard Cohen in front of his home. You have to actually walk up a long stairway to get to this terrace. And this is taken in around 61 or 62. And he had no running water in the house, as he had no electricity. When he bought the house in 1960, he's just filled up his jug from a cistern and carried it up the stairs and about to go in that front door. This is the terrace on which he wrote Beautiful Losers. And I think we have a photograph of that coming up. By August 61, Cohen was back in Greece, having spent 21 days on a Yugoslavian freighter headed for Genoa, Italy. Most of the passengers on the freighter were retirees returning to Italy to live on welfare. And he tells his sister that, quote, "they weep most of the day, and they eat large meals. Just like home for me." He befriended the 33-year-old captain, spending most nights of the interminable journey musing on a destiny, quote, "that makes one man the master of a ship, the other an itinerant poet, both exiles." All this, he says, under a large photo of Marshal Tito. But he knows that he will soon be, quote, "rooted on the rock of Hedra, working in that freedom which only an ocean between me and my birthplace can give me." On Hedra, with its whitewashed walls and narrow streets surrounding the port, quote, "his Gothic insincerities were purged and his style purified under the influence of empty mountains and a foreign mate who cherished simple English, as he would write 2 years later. Leonard Cohen is here photographed in what really was the music room of his house in Hedra, and it's probably a better known room for this picture, which is the reverse side of his album, Songs from a Room. This is a photograph of Marianne Ihlen, or Ihlen, a Norwegian woman that he shared the house with for about 6.5 years. And there's been a lot of postmodern interpretation of the skull and the towel, but I'll leave that to your own imagination. Cohen needed the freedom from Canadian rhetoric and morals and embraced the isolation of the island because it permitted him to work intensely. This is a picture of Leonard Cohen with his famous green Olivetti typewriter while he is typing Beautiful Losers, his novel of 1966. Leonard Cohen writes, "Thank God for hashish, cognac, and neurotic women who pay their debts with flesh," he wrote to Jack McClellan, adding that the products of the island are, and I quote again, sponges, movies, nervous breakdowns, and divorces. But Greece wasn't entirely romance and literary purity. Later that August, 1961, he would write Leighton that he had seen corpses in the sea and witnessed assassins' drugs. Leighton was uncharacteristically indifferent. Quote, "I gather the Greek wines are too strong for him," he commented to a friend. Meanwhile, Cohen was still seeking extra funds, this time from an advance on royalties of the Spice Box of Earth, encouraging Jack McClellan, quote, "to dig deep to keep Cohen out of the clothing business," unquote. You may or may not know that the family business was called Friedman & Company, and they were the largest manufacturers of men's top coats and suits in Canada for about 2.5 decades. This was the business that his father was in and that his uncles also operated. The events in Cuba and after form a continuum of Leonard Cohen's life, which he transformed into art. And Zen, more recently, has given him quite an equilibrium in his life. Oh, we got to go back one. Thank you. This is a favorite photograph of mine. This is actually Leonard Cohen in Japan in about 1975. It illustrates, I think, so well the contrast between a Leonard Cohen who either is a very unhappy businessman on a trip from Westmount, or possibly a spy with the trench coat, thank you, and the Zen monk next to him who is offering protection in the sense from the rain. I like the contrast of this particular photograph. I think it's very revealing. The next photograph shows you also Leonard in meditation. He's wearing a black leather motorcycle jacket here. So it, again, displays another element of the character of Leonard Cohen. What's particularly significant about this photograph is the figure to my left, to your left. That is Leonard's Zen teacher, Joshiru Sasaki Roshi, who is now 89 years old. Again, this picture is from the 70s. Leonard Cohen is devoted to this man and has now pretty much removed himself, at least from the public, in order to care for, to cook, to drive, to accompany Roshi as Roshi travels around North America and indeed even Europe teaching his form of Rinzai Buddhism. Roshi is quite an amazing figure. I have spent some time with Roshi. And the man is, to put it mildly, a presence. A presence. Okay. The poems that and attempted prose fiction that Leonard Cohen wrote during the 60s, or 61 really, record his encounter with a world that equally fascinated and threatened him. Temporarily, it was a perfect world for him, as Greece would soon become with its liberalism and repression, with its drugs and its danger. What his experiences in Cuba show are the ways he survived as a poet, not a revolutionary, and how through the eyes of this biographer at least, they encapsulate a pattern of pursuit and inscription, which his work manifests and a later letter confirms. This is another image, I hope, yes, of Leonard Cohen, Live Songs. This is Leonard after his first encounter with Buddhism. The photograph was actually taken in, of all places, Acapulco. You wouldn't know it, would you? After he went over the wall from the Mount Baldy Zen Center early in the 70s during a very severe winter, he did what any creative artist would have done in most circumstances, get to the sun in a hot climate. What his experiences in Cuba show are the way in which he survived as a poet, not a revolutionary, and how through the eyes of myself, they encapsulate this pattern of pursuit and inscription, which I think is illustrated by his work, and this late letter confirms. What a joyless farce we make of our lives, especially the cautious, especially them, because what they hoard is leaking away day by day. Give me war. Give me complicated divorces and disgrace. Give me broken lives and alcoholic fantasy. Give me anything but pettiness and safety. Oh, did we go too far? Yeah. He ends this letter with a celebration of a new dance, which he believes embodies a new liberalism. Some of you may have not only heard of this dance, but actually performed it. It's called The Twist. And he writes, "It's the first time I've really enjoyed dancing. I sometimes even forget I belong to an inferior race. I mean, the twist is the greatest ritual since circumcision. And there you can choose between the genius of two cultures. Myself, I prefer the twist." Now, this particular picture, which was used as the cover of his 1988 album, I'm Your Man, was actually photographed in a warehouse while Jennifer Warrens was making a video. And he's commented about the accuracy of this photograph because it shows that even though you may want to stand in your most coolest pose, there's always something which exposes you. And what exposes him at this point, naturally, is that banana. Now, what I'm going to attempt to do, if this all works, is to end, because we have come to the point of closing time, by showing you, and I'm going to put the lights on for a second, at least some of these lights, a video. But I'm going to have to put more lights on because we can't see anything here. This is the video which is called Closing Time, which won an award for Leonard Cohen. Let's see what happens.
And we're dancing and the band is really happening and the Johnny Walker wisdom running high. And my very sweet companion, she's the angel of compassion. She's rubbing up the world against her thigh. And every drinker, every dancer lifts a happy face to thank her. The fiddler fiddles something so sublime. All the women tear their blouses off, and the men they dance on the polka dots. And his partner found, and his partner lost, and it's hell to pay when the fiddler stops. It's closing time. It's hell to pay when the fiddler stops. It's closing time. Not we're lonely, we're romantic and sad, at least with acid and the holy spirit's crying. Where's the bee? And the moon is swimming naked and the summer night is fragrant with a mighty expectation of relief. So we struggle and we stagger down the snakes and up like this, a sigh, a cry, a hungry kiss. The gates of love, they buzz and inch. I can't say much has happened since the closing time. Just like this, a sigh, cry, a hungry kiss. The gates of love, they buzz and inch. I can't say much has happened since.
Can't say much has happened since.
Can't say much has happened since.
But closing time.
Closing time.
I loved you for your beauty, but that doesn't make a fool of me. For your beauty too, and I loved you for your body. There's a voice that sounds like God to me, declaring that your body's really you. And I loved you when our love was blessed, and I love you now. There's nothing left but sorrow and a sense of overtime. I missed you since a place got wrecked, and I just don't care what happens next. Looks like freedom, but it feels like death. It's something in between. I guess it's closing time. Yeah, I missed you since our place got wrecked by the winds of change and the weeds of sex. And it looks like freedom, but it feels like death. It's something in between. I guess it's closing time. Yeah, we're drinking and we're dancing, but there's nothing really happening, and the place is dead as heaven on a Saturday night. And my very close companion gets me falling, gets me laughing. She's a hundred, but she's wearing something tight. And I lift my glass to the awful truth, which can't reveal to the ears of youth, except to say it isn't worth a dime. And the whole damn place goes crazy twice, and it's once for the devil and it's once for Christ. But the boss don't like these dizzy heights. We're busted in the blinding lights of closing time. Goes crazy twice, and it's once for the devil and it's once for Christ. But the boss don't like these dizzy heights. We're busted in the blinding light.
Busted in the blinding light.
Busted in the blinding light of closing time. Closing time. Oh, the women tear the blouses off, and the men they dance on the polka dots. It's closing time. And it's partner found, and it's partner lost, and it's hell to pay when the fiddler stops. It's closing time. I swear it happened just like this, a sigh, a cry, a hungry kiss. It's
closing time.
Can't say much has happened since, but closing
time.
I loved you when our love was blessed. I love you now. There's nothing left.
Every time.
Well, we have reached our closing time. Thank you very much.
Time, we'll have some questions. You want to start off, Robert?
I'd like to ask, what in particular about a poem aroused your interest to devote so much of your energy to it?
The question, which I shall repeat, is why did I spend so much time pursuing Leonard Cohen, essentially? I've not avoided this question. It's been asked before. There are a number of reasons. One of the important reasons is that I wanted to try and understand why Leonard Cohen has received the kind of attention why he obtained the kind of reputation that he does, not just in Canada, but way beyond Canada. I mean, the enthusiasm for Leonard Cohen in Europe is something that you have to witness and experience to know the depth and the breadth of that kind of reputation. And I wanted to know why. What is it about a writer who is very modestly taught in either universities or in high schools that nevertheless has published 10 or 11 books? And what is it about a singer who admittedly cannot sing? He says this himself. He's not ashamed to say that only in a Canada-like country would he win Male Vocalist of the Year. So what's going on here? So it was this kind of curiosity and this kind of ambiguity that spurred me to somehow come up with some explanation. I would hardly say answers, but explanation. And then as you begin to look at least the outline of his life, it's not a typical route, either as an artist, a singer, or as a writer. I'm thinking particularly of the long period spent outside of Canada in the island of Hedra, and even now, spending such a great deal of his life in California. And I've just come back from Los Angeles, where people asked me frequently in a variety of interviews, how do you explain this popularity of Leonard Cohen, especially in Canada? And part of my answer would is really, it's his absence from Canada that makes him so important and significant. And he himself has said that one of the reasons he remains in California, although he visits Montreal, he visits under duress, Toronto, and occasionally Vancouver, it's because he cannot walk down the street and just go to the cleaners, which he can do in Los Angeles with a fair amount of anonymity.
Robert, you'll want to get the book.
Thank you very much. Eric is getting a small cut, you see.
Good. More questions now. Yes, question over there.
Okay, what is the state of his spiritual journey at this point? I suggested when we saw a couple of slides about his devotion to this particular teacher, Roshi. Leonard Cohen became interested in Rinzai Zen Buddhism in about 1972, but did not become a practicing Zen Buddhist till about 1974-75. And it has affected him very deeply and very strongly. And I want to say, first of all, that he sees no conflict whatsoever with his Judaism, and that he turned to Zen Buddhism because he found an absence of something in his Jewish belief and Jewish practice, and what he found missing was a meditational dimension. And he located this in Zen practice, and through that kind of Zen practice, which he defines as a training. And you would say, but Leonard, a training for what? And he would answer by saying a training in self-reform. It helps, Zen helps him understand himself and rid what he, in his words, would suggest are various doubts, anxieties, conflicts, which does not mean that Zen replaces his Judaic beliefs. In fact, I have a letter in the biography that he wrote in 1993 to a newspaper where he took great offense at being called a Zen Buddhist. He said, absolutely not, I'm Jewish. But the Zen Buddhism enhances my whole spiritual identity. And it's very important to see that they don't cancel each other, but they complement each other.
Way back there.
Yes. Do you have one of the Friedman & Company coats? Okay, because I did in my research turn up someone from Sherbrooke, Quebec, who dealt with the Friedman Company and had some of their coats and sport jackets. The company went out of business in the mid-60s, partly because there were no other children to take over the company, and it was just the competition was too difficult for it. But it was very, very successful, extremely successful for its time. He worked there. He worked occasionally there. He worked unhappily there.
Back there.
Oh, I was waiting all night for you to ask me that question. Okay, the question was, will I talk about the poem on the wall? Marita, please find me, I'm nearly 30. It's a curious little story because someone called me on the phone and said, you're interested in Leonard Cohen, you know that poem called Marita? And I said, oh yes, one of the few poems I have memorized. And he said, well, do you know who Marita is? And I said, no, absolutely not. He said, I can tell you everything about her. And I said, sure. He said, well, meet me for lunch. And it was a wonderful gentleman in his 70s from Montreal who was visiting Vancouver. And he explained to me that Marita was his wife. And Marita managed a dress shop across the street from this cafe on Mountain Street in Montreal. And many afternoons she would come in to have a glass of wine, where the young Leonard Cohen, who was quite taken with the appearance of this woman, would frequently approach her and ask her out. And at one point, after this happened many times, she put her hand on Leonard's shoulder. He thought it was a great invitation. And she said, Leonard, come back and see me when you're nearly 30. And so he wrote the poem, Marita, please find me, I'm nearly 30. That's the story. And you found it, heard it first here in this book. Don't go to any other source. Yes?
I'd like to know if he's still smoking.
That is a very clever question. Well, is Leonard Cohen still smoking? That was not part of the original question. The answer is yes, he started smoking again. May I ask why you want to know? Why do you want to know why he's still smoking? Okay. He went through a period of reform, but to my surprise, he's indulging again. There are certain other things that have been consistent in his life. The first meeting I had with him in California, the one I described about eating, was preceded by a cup of coffee, which had the largest amount of Crown Royal I have ever had to encounter at 8:30 in the morning. But somebody's got to do it, and I took on the responsibility.
Question over here.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
What effect do you think Leonard Cohen has had or will have on eating writers, especially
young women? Oh, that's a big question. That's right. What is the question? What effect will Leonard Cohen have on Canadian writers, particularly young writers? I think he has and will have a great effect on songwriters. His role as a musician and songwriter is quite significant, and one only has to spend some time with contemporary songwriters and musicians to understand that. Singers, as well, are strongly influenced by Leonard Cohen, neatly expressed in a remark that a singer made to me when she said, you know, to sing the songs of Leonard Cohen, you need a PhD. Because the lyrics are so, not difficult, but they're complex, and they're strong lyrics. And, you know, Leonard Cohen, to quote someone else I recently spoke to, said, you know, he writes heavy songs. He writes heavy songs. But if you speak to singers like Jennifer Warren's, that's the very attraction to Leonard Cohen, is precisely because he does not use a popular song as a toss-off. He doesn't write about putting the top down and driving around Marine Drive, okay? He writes about other things. In terms of poets and novelists, I think there's much to learn from the kind of experimentation that goes on in his work, especially in Beautiful Losers. I would place that really at the top of all of his literary efforts.
I've got a PhD and I can't sing his song.
But can you play the guitar?
Yes, over here.
Has Leonard Cohen ever had any children? Leonard Cohen has two children, 24 and 22, Adam and Lorca. The daughter is named Lorca, which is another indication of his, what should we say, acknowledgement of the influence of Lorca, the poet, on his life. They currently live in California, and that was a very question raised by Entertainment Weekly, a distinguished literary journal, I've learned, when they commented on my book, and they thought it was good and this and that, but in the Where Are They Now category, what has ever happened to Adam and Lorca? I should qualify this, though, by saying Leonard Cohen has never been legally married.
Way back there, then here.
Yes. The question is, I made reference to Leonard Cohen's father. Could I expand on that? I'd like to indulge myself and share with you the first paragraph of the book proper. It is the following. Leonard Cohen buried the first thing he ever wrote. After his father died, he cut open one of his formal bow ties, sewed a message into it, then buried it in the snow in the small garden behind his Montreal home. For a 9-year-old boy, it was a powerful and symbolic gesture. In effect, Cohn conducted his own private burial, substituting prose for an outward expression of grief. So I think that pretty clearly summarizes the situation. The father died when Leonard Cohn was 9 years old.
Yes.
Well, you can't really say it's 35% fictional and the rest, you know. Oh, the question was Leonard Cohen's first novel, The Favorite Game, published in 1963, is quite, at least on the surface, autobiographical. And it's been pointed out that in my account of Cohen's life, there doesn't seem to be that much of a connection between his actual life and that novel. And I wanted to respond by saying that it's very difficult to put a percentage on the novel to suggest that this part is fictional and this part is autobiographical. I think that the very last third of the novel, which is set at the summer camp, is amazingly autobiographical. So much so, I have a photograph in the book, which none of you can see from back there. It's a camp photograph. And it was taken in the summer of 1958 when Leonard Cohen was a counselor at this camp. And among the many wonderful things about this photograph is that one of the principal characters, a sort of idiot savant in The Favorite Game, appears in this photograph and is identified. So there are certain aspects of that book which are very carefully connected to his life, and there are other parts which are made up. I should also say that the published novel is about the fourth version of the original typescript, which was so autobiographical that he had the real names of everyone in the first draft. And I alluded to the discovery of a typescript in a garage in California, and that's what was found, was the first draft of The Favorite Game, where every name is an actual person in his life.
We have two more questions. One over here. Yeah.
I find myself remembering the words of another Jewish songwriter. I muttered underneath my breath, "Nothing is easy." And I think I'm one of a dozen Canadians who truly love Leonard Cohen's work. I'm really blown over by it. But I understand nothing about the man at all. Before I came here and now. Can I ask one question?
Wait a minute. Now, do you understand something? Or you still? Okay.
At least a small question.
Yes. No.
What's the question?
Oh. The question has to do with three important contemporary 20th century songwriters, Paul Simon, Leonard Cohen, and Bob Dylan, that they're all Jewish. Do I think being Jewish has anything to do with that? And I said no. Leonard Cohen, well, we'll talk. We don't really have to end at 9:30 or 9:40.
Last question.
Last question. The question is, do I find my own identity threatened because I've immersed myself in Leonard Cohen's life?
Who are you?
It is true I'm taking guitar lessons. And we'll stop there. Thank you.
Before I ask Professor Earl Drebeck to thank our speaker today, let me just give you two quick reminders. One is that as you leave, please be kind or friendly to the people outside who are collecting memberships. It helps to keep the Institute going. Second point is that we have two more lectures before Christmas, one next Saturday, Chuck Davis speaking about today, Vancouver, tomorrow, everything. And then a rather different talk, Alan Cairns, who is well known to the Institute, comes back from frozen Saskatchewan on November 30th to talk about Canada, Can We Survive? I'm now going to ask Professor Earl Derbach, who does not write reviews for Cosmopolitan magazine, to thank our speaker.
I'm actually standing in for the Dean of Arts, who's asked me to thank Ira. Ira, Shirley says thank you. I would much rather thank Ira on my own account. We've been friends and colleagues for, 25 years or something. No mean feat. We both teach in the English department. It would save me about 1,000 words of thanks to remind you of a photograph that I was half hoping Ira would show you this evening of Ira Nadell, which appeared in one of the glossy magazines about 2 months ago, Ira walking on water. You remember the photograph? It's really quite an amazing photograph. Of course, he's not walking on water, not really. He's wearing a pair of gumboots and he's standing in a pool. But it looks as if Ira is walking on water. And what is most remarkable about the photograph is that the top half of the body seems absolutely indifferent to the pose of the lower half of the body. Ira is looking with extraordinary erudition into the middle distance, with profundity on his face. One hand is placed nonchalantly in his, I think it's his left pocket, and he is most impeccably dressed. Now, I think this says a lot about Ira. I mean, in a 10-part mixture, I would say he is 5 parts extraordinary erudition. He is at least 3 parts extraordinary sartorial elegance. And 2 parts sheer bloody chutzpah. Now, it will not have eluded your observation. It certainly didn't elude that of our last question, that Ira is actually turning into his research subject. You will notice that he actually looks like Leonard Cohen and dresses like Leonard Cohen, which rather confirms a theory that I have, that we don't really choose our research subjects, that our research subjects choose us. That George Bernard Shaw has chosen a politically erudite vegetarian. That Conrad has chosen a peripatetic Polish gentleman who speaks the most eloquent English. And Leonard Cohen has gone in search of somebody with a comparable combination of profundity, style, and sheer bloody chutzpah. And so I would like to thank Ira, if I may walk temporarily on water, on Leonard Cohen's behalf for choosing him. And I would like to thank Ira on your behalf for this absolutely enchanting talk. Thank you.